Good surgeons must understand the consequences of each action, for they're often not able to see what's happening on the other side of the area in which they're actually working. Some people have the gift of physical coordination. These are the people who become Olympic stars. Others can sing beautifully. Some people have a natural ear for languages or a special aptitude for math. I know individuals who seem to draw friends, who have a unique ability to make people feel welcome and part of the family. For some reason, I am able to see in three dimensions. In fact, it seems incredibly simple. It's just something I happen to be able to do. However, many doctors don't have this natural ability, and some, including surgeons, never learn this skill. Those who don't pick this up just don't develop into outstanding surgeons, frequently encountering problems, constantly fighting complications. I first became aware of this ability when a classmate pointed it out at Yale. He and I used to play table soccer, sometimes called foosball, and, although I had never played before, almost from the first lesson I did it with speed and ease. I didn't realize it then, but it was because of this ability. When I visited Yale in early 1988, I chatted with a former classmate who was on staff there. He laughingly told me that I had been so good at the game that afterward they named several plays Carson shots. During my studies at medical school and the years afterward, I realized the value of this skill. For me, it is the most significant talent God has given me, and the reason people sometimes say I have gifted hands. After my first year in med school, I had a summer job as a radiology technician taking x-rays. It was the only free summer I had from then on. I enjoyed it because I learned a lot about x-rays, how they worked, and how to use the equipment. I didn't realize it at the time, but subsequently, this would be useful to me in research. The medical school administration offered selected seniors opportunities as instructors, and by my senior year, I was doing extremely well, receiving academic honors as well as recommendations in my clinical rotations. At one point, I taught physical diagnosis to first and second year students. In the evenings, they came over and we practiced on each other. We learned how to listen to the sounds of our hearts and lungs, for example, and how to test reflexes. It was an incredibly good experience, and the job forced me to work hard to be ready for my students. I didn't begin in the top of my class, however. In my first year of med school, my work was only average. That's when I learned the importance of truly in-depth learning. I used to go to lectures without getting much from them, particularly when the speaker was boring. But I didn't learn much either. For me, it paid to thoroughly study the textbooks for each course. During my second year, I went to few lectures. Normally, I got out of bed around 6 a.m. and would go over and over the textbooks until I knew every concept and detail in them. Enterprising individuals took extremely good notes for the lectures and then, for a little cash, sold their notes. I was one of the purchasers, and I studied the notes as thoroughly as the texts. All during my second year, I did little else but study from the time I awakened until 11 o'clock at night. By the time my third year rolled around, when I could work on the wards, I knew my material cold. Chapter 11. Another Step Forward. There ought to be an easier way, I thought, as I watched my instructor. A skilled neurosurgeon, he knew what he was doing, but he had difficulty locating the foramen ovale, the hole at the base of the skull. The woman on whom he was operating had a condition called trigeminal neuralgia, a painful condition of the face. "This is the hardest part," the man said as he probed with a long, thin needle. "Just locating the foramen ovale." Then I started to argue with myself. "You're new at neurosurgery, but already you think you know everything, huh? Remember, Ben, these guys have been doing this kind of surgery for years." "Yeah," answered another inner voice. "But that doesn't mean they know everything. Just leave it alone. One day you'll get your chance to change the world." I would have stopped arguing with myself, except I couldn't get away from thinking that there must be an easier way. Having to probe for the foramen ovale wasted precious surgery time and didn't help the patient either. "Okay, smart man. Find it then." And that's just what I decided to do. I was doing my clinical year at the University of Michigan's School of Medicine, and was in my neurosurgery rotation. Each of the rotations lasted a month, and it was during this period that the surgeon commented on the difficulty of finding the little hole at the base of the skull. After arguing with myself for some time, I took advantage of the friends I had made the previous summer when I worked as a radiology technician. I went to them and explained what was worrying me. They were interested and gave me permission to come into their department and practice with the equipment. After several days of thinking and trying different things, I hit upon a simple technique of placing two tiny metal rings on the back and front of the skull, and then aligning the rings so that the foramen ovale fell exactly between them. Using this technique, doctors could save a lot of time and energy instead of poking around inside the skull. I had reasoned it this way. Since two points determine a line, I could put one ring on the outside surface of the skull behind the area where the foramen ovale should be. I then would put the other one on the front of the skull. By passing an X-ray beam through the skull, I could turn the head until the rings lined up. At that point, the foramen falls in between. The procedure seemed simple and obvious, once I'd reasoned it out, but apparently no one had thought of it before. Fact is, I didn't tell anyone either. I was thinking of how to do a better job and wasn't concerned with impressing anybody or showing my instructors a new technique. For a short time, I tormented myself by asking, am I getting into a new realm of things that others haven't yet discovered, or am I just thinking I've figured out a technique no one else has considered before? Finally, I decided that I had developed a method that worked for me, and that was the important thing. I started doing this procedure and, from actual surgery, saw how much easier it was. After two such surgeries, I told my neurosurgeon professors how I was doing it, and then demonstrated for them. The head professor watched, shook his head slowly, and smiled. "That's fabulous, Carson." Fortunately, the neurosurgery professors didn't resent my idea. I still use the principle of this procedure, but I've done so many of these surgeries and gotten so experienced at finding the hole, I don't need to go through the steps. I know exactly where the foramen ovale is. From just having an interest in neurosurgery, the field soon intrigued me so much it became a compulsion. You may have noticed that I'd had that happen before. "I have to know more," I'd find myself thinking. Everything available in print on the subject became an article I had to read. Because of my intense concentration and my driving desire to know more, without intending to, I began to outshine the interns. It was during my second rotation, my fourth year of med school, that I became aware that I knew more about neurosurgery than the interns and junior residents. While we were making our rounds, as part of the teaching procedure, the professors questioned us as we examined patients. If none of the residents knew the answer, the professor would invariably turn to me, "Carson, suppose you tell them." Fortunately, I always could, although I was still a medical student, and quite naturally, knowing I excelled in this area produced a real emotional high. I had worked hard and pursued an in-depth knowledge, and it was paying off. And why not? If I was going to be a doctor, I was going to be the best, most informed doctor I could possibly be. About this time, several of the interns and residents started turning over a few of their responsibilities to me. I don't think I'll ever forget the first time a resident said, "Carson, you know so much. Why don't you carry the beeper and answer the calls? If you get into something you can't handle, just holler. I'll be in the lounge catching a little sleep." He wasn't supposed to do that, of course, but he was exhausted, and I was so delighted to have the opportunity to practice and learn that I enthusiastically agreed. Before long, the other residents were handing me their beepers or turning cases over to me. Perhaps they were taking advantage of me, and in a sense they were, because the added responsibility meant longer hours and more work for me. But I loved neurosurgery and the excitement of being involved in actually performing the operations so much that I would have taken on even more if they had asked. I'm sure the professors knew what was going on, but they never mentioned it, and I certainly wasn't going to tell. I loved being a medical student. I was the first man on the line taking care of problems, and I was having the most fun I'd ever had in my life. No problems ever arose over my workload, and I maintained a good relationship with the interns and residents. Through all of these extra opportunities, I became convinced that I enjoyed this specialty more than anything else I tried. Often as I walked through the wards, I'd think, if this is so great now while I'm still a student, it's going to be even better when I finish my residency. Each day I went on rounds or to the lectures or operating theater. An attitude of excitement and adventure filled my thoughts because I knew I was gaining experience and information while sharpening my skills. All the things that would enable me to be a first-rate neurosurgeon. By then, I found myself in my fourth year of medical school, ready for my 1 year of internship and then my residency. Professionally, I was heading in the right direction, without any question. As a kid, I had wanted to be a missionary doctor and then got caught up in psychiatry. Now and then, as part of our training, the medical students watched presentations in clinical medicine made by various specialists who talked about their particular field. The neurosurgeons impressed me the most. When they talked and showed us before and after pictures, they held my attention like none of the others. "They're amazing," I'd say to myself. "Those guys can do anything." But the first few times I looked down upon a human brain, or saw human hands working upon that center of intelligence and emotion and motion, working to help heal, I was hooked. Then, realizing that my hands were steady and that I could intuitively see the effect my hands had on the brain, I knew I had found my calling. And so I made the choice that would become my career and my life. All the facets of my career came together then. First, my interest in neurosurgery. Second, my growing interest in the study of the brain. And third, acceptance of my God-given talent of eye and hand coordination, my gifted hands that fitted me for this field. When I made my choice for neurosurgery, it seemed the most natural thing in the world. In medical school, during our clinical, or third, year, we did rotation work for a month at a time, giving us an opportunity to experience each of the fields. I signed up for and received permission to do 2 neurosurgery rotations. Both times, I received honors in my work. Michigan had an outstanding neurosurgery program, and except for a casual incident, I would have stayed at Michigan for my internship and residency. I believe residency works much better if you're in the same place you took your previous work. One day I overheard a conversation that changed the shape of my plans. An instructor, unaware that I was nearby, commented to another about the chairman of our neurosurgery department. "He's on his way out," he said. "You think it's that serious?" the other man asked. "Without question. He told me so himself. Too much political strife." That chance conversation forced me to rethink my future at the U of M. The change of personnel would severely damage the residency program. When an interim chairman comes on the scene, he's new, uncertain, and has no idea how long he'll stay. Along with that, chaos and uncertainty reign among the residents. Loyalties often divide, and personnel changes occur. I didn't want to get caught up in that because I believed it could adversely affect my work and my future. The combination of that piece of information and the fact that I'd long admired the Johns Hopkins complex made me decide to apply at Hopkins. I had no trepidation at sending in my application for internship at Hopkins the fall of 1976 because I felt that I was as good as anybody else at that point in my training. I had made excellent grades and achieved high scores on the national board examinations. Only one problem faced me. Johns Hopkins accepted only 2 students a year for neurosurgery residency, although they averaged 125 applications. I sent in my application and within weeks received the marvelous news that I would be interviewed at Johns Hopkins. That didn't put me in the program, but it got me inside the door. I knew that with the competition as stiff as it was, they interviewed but few of the applicants. The manner of Dr. George Udvarhai, head of the neurosurgery training program, put me at ease immediately. His office was large, tastefully decorated with antiques. He spoke with a soft Hungarian accent. The smoke from his pipe lent a sweet fragrance to the room. He began by asking questions, and I felt he honestly wanted to know my answers. I also sensed that he would be fair in his evaluation and recommendation. "Tell me a little about yourself," Dr. Udvarhai began, looking across his desk at me. His manner was straightforward, interested, and I relaxed. I took a deep breath and looked him in the eyes. Did I dare to be myself? "Help me, Lord," I prayed. "If this is your will for me, if this is the place you know I should be, Help me to give the answers that will open the doors to this school. Johns Hopkins is certainly my first choice, I began. It's also my only choice. This is the place where I want to be this fall. Had I said that too strongly? I wondered. Had I been too open about what I wanted? I didn't know, but I had decided before going to Baltimore for the interview that, above all, I wanted to be myself and to be accepted or rejected by who I was, and not because I successfully projected some kind of image through a super sales job. After he gained a few bits of information about me, Dr. Udvar-Hai's questions revolved around medicine. Why did you choose to become a doctor? He asked. His hands rested on his large desk. What aspirations do you have? What are your primary fields of interest? I tried to answer clearly and concisely each time. However, at some point in the conversation, Dr. Udvar-Hai made an oblique reference to a concert he had attended the night before. Yes, sir, I said. I was there. You were? He asked, and I saw the startled expression on his face. Did you enjoy it? Very much, I said, adding that the violin soloist had not been quite as good as I had expected. He leaned forward, his face animated. I thought the same thing. He was fine, technically fine, but I don't remember the rest of the interview except that Dr. Udvar-Hai honed in on classical music, and we talked for a long time, maybe an hour, about various composers and their different styles of music. I think he was taken aback by the fact that this black kid from Detroit knew so much about classical music. When the interview concluded and I left his office, I wondered if I had gotten Dr. Udvar-Hai off track and the digression would count against me. I consoled myself with the thought that he had brought up the topic and he had kept the subject foremost in our conversation. Years later, Dr. Udvar-Hai told me that he had made a strong case for my being accepted to Dr. Long, the chairman. Ben, he said to me, I was impressed with your grades, your honors and recommendations, and the splendid way you handled yourself in the interview. Although he didn't say it, I'm convinced that my interest in classical music was a decisive factor. And I pleasantly remembered the hours of study during high school I had put into being able to compete on College Bowl. Ironically, the year I entered college, College Bowl went off the air. More than once I had scolded myself for wasting a lot of time learning about the arts when it would never be used or needed. I learned something from that experience. No knowledge is ever wasted. To quote the Apostle Paul, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God. Romans 8:28. The love I learned for classical music helped draw Candy and me together, and also helped me get into one of the best neurosurgery programs in the United States. When we work hard to acquire expertise or understanding in any field, it pays off. In this case, at least, I saw how it certainly had yielded results. I also believe that God has an overall plan for people's lives, and the details get worked out along the way, even though we usually have no idea what's going on. I was elated when I received word that I'd been accepted into the neurosurgery program at Johns Hopkins. Now I was going to get the chance for training at what I considered the greatest training hospital in the world. Doubts concerning the field of medicine I should specialize in vanished. With confidence born of a good mother, hard work, and trust in God, I knew I was a good doctor. What I didn't know, I could learn. I can learn to do anything that anybody else can do, I said to Candy several times. Maybe I was a little overconfident, but I don't think I felt cocky and certainly never superior. I recognized others' abilities as well, but in any career, whether it's that of a TV repairman, a musician, a secretary, or a surgeon, an individual must believe in himself and in his abilities. To do his best, one needs a confidence that says, I can do anything, and if I can't do it, I know how to get help. Life was moving beautifully for me during this time. I'd been awarded a variety of honors for my clinical work at the University of Michigan, and now I was entering the last, and perhaps most important, phase of my training. My private life was even better. Candy graduated from Yale in the spring of 1975, and we married July 6th, between my second and third years of med school. Until our marriage, I lived with Curtis. Still unmarried at that time, he had received his discharge after 4 years of naval service and then enrolled at the U of M to finish college. Candy and I rented our own apartment in Ann Arbor, and she easily found a job with the state unemployment office. For the next 2 years, she processed unemployment claims and kept our home while I finished med school. It was exciting to move to Baltimore from the relatively small town of Ann Arbor. During our time there, Candy worked for Connecticut General Insurance Company. Because of her temporary status, she found a job doing standard clerical-type work. She also briefly had a job selling vacuum cleaners, and then she got a job at Johns Hopkins as an editorial assistant for one of the chemistry professors. For 2 years, Candy typed for several different Johns Hopkins publications and did some editing. During that 2 year period, she also took advantage of the opportunity of our being at Johns Hopkins and went back to school. Since she was an employee of the university and married to a resident, Candy could go to school free. She continued with her coursework and earned her master's degree in business. Then she went over to Mercantile Bank and Trust and started working in trust administration. I worked hard as a resident at Johns Hopkins. One of my goals was to maintain a good rapport with everyone, because I don't believe in one-person productions. Everyone on the team is important and needs to know that he or she is vital. However, a few of the doctors tended to be snobbish, and that bothered me. They wouldn't bother to talk with the common people, like ward clerks or aides. That attitude troubled me, and I hurt for those dedicated employees when I saw it happening. We doctors couldn't be effective without the support of the clerks and aides. From the start, I made a point to talk to the so-called lowly people and to get to know them. After all, where had I come from? I had a good teacher, my mother, who had taught me that people are just people. Their income or position in life doesn't make them better or worse than anyone else. When I had free minutes, I'd chew the fat on the wards and get to know the names of the people who worked with us. Actually, this turned out to be an advantage, although I didn't plan it that way. During my residency, I realized that some of the nurses and clerks had been on their jobs for 25 or 30 years. Because of their practical experience in observing and working with patients, they could teach me things. And they did. I also realized that they recognized things that were going on with patients that I had no way of knowing. By working closely with specific patients, they sensed changes and needs before they became obvious. Once they accepted me, these often unpraised workers quietly let me know, for instance, those I could trust or those I couldn't. They'd inform me when things were going wrong on the ward. More than once, a ward clerk, on her way out the door after her shift, would pause and say, "Oh, by the way," and let me know of a problem with the patient. The staff had no obligation to tell anyone, but many of them had developed an uncanny ability to sense problems, especially relapses and complications. They trusted me to listen and to act on their perceptions. Maybe I began developing a relationship with the staff because I wanted to compensate for the way some of the other doctors treated them. I'm not sure. I know I hated it when a resident disregarded a suggestion from a nurse. When one of them tongue-lashed a ward clerk for a simple mistake, I felt bad and a little protective toward the victim. At any rate, because of the help from the lower echelons, I was able to make an excellent showing and to do a good job. Today, I try to emphasize this point when I speak to young people. "There isn't anybody in the world who isn't worth something," I say. "If you're nice to them, they'll be nice to you. The same people you meet on the way up are the same kind of people you meet on the way down. Besides that, every person you meet is one of God's children." I truly believe that being a successful neurosurgeon doesn't mean I'm better than anybody else. It means that I'm fortunate because God gave me the talent to do this job well. I also believe that what talents I have, I need to be willing to share with others. Chapter 12. Coming into My Own. The nurse looked at me with disinterest as I walked toward her station. "Yes?" she asked, pausing with a pencil in her hand. "Who did you come to pick up?" From the tone of her voice, I immediately knew that she thought I was an orderly. I was wearing my green scrubs, nothing to indicate I was a doctor. "I didn't come to pick up anyone," I looked at her and smiled, realizing that the only black people she had seen on the floor had been orderlies. Why should she think anything else? I'm the new intern.
New intern? But you can't... I mean, I didn't mean to...
The nurse stuttered, trying to apologize without sounding prejudiced. That's okay, I said, letting her off the hook. It was a natural mistake. I'm new, so why should you know who I am? The first time I went into the intensive care unit, I was wearing my whites, our monkey suits, as we interns called them, and a nurse signaled me. You're here for Mr. Jordan? No, ma'am, I'm not. You sure? She asked as a frown covered her forehead. He's the only one who's scheduled for respiratory therapy today. By then I had come closer, and she could read my name badge and the word intern under my name. Oh, I'm so very sorry, she said, and I could tell she was. Although I didn't say it, I would like to have told her, it's all right, because I realize most people do things based on their past experiences. You've never encountered a black intern before, so you assumed I was the only kind of black male you'd seen wearing whites, a respiratory therapist. I smiled again and went on. It was inevitable that a few white patients didn't want a black doctor, and they protested to Dr. Long. One woman said, I'm sorry, but I do not want a black physician in on my case. Dr. Long had a standard answer given in a calm but firm voice. There's the door. You're welcome to walk through it. But if you stay here, Dr. Carson will handle your case. At the time, people were making these objections. I didn't know about them. Only much later did Dr. Long tell me as he laughed about the prejudices of some patients. But there was no humor in his voice when he defined his position. He was adamant about his stance, allowing no prejudice because of color or ethnic background. Of course, I knew how some individuals felt. I would have had to be pretty insensitive not to know. The way they behaved, their coldness, even without saying anything, made their feelings clear. Each time, however, I was able to remind myself that they were individuals speaking for themselves and not representative of all whites. No matter how strongly a patient felt, as soon as he voiced his objection, he learned that Dr. Long would dismiss him on the spot if he said anything more. So far as I know, none of the patients ever left. I honestly felt no great pressures. When I did encounter prejudice, I could hear Mother's voice in the back of my head saying things like, "Some people are ignorant, and you have to educate them." The only pressure I felt during my internship, and in the years since, has been a self-imposed obligation to act as a role model for black youngsters. These young folks need to know that the way to escape their often dismal situations is contained within themselves. They can't expect other people to do it for them. Perhaps I can't do much, but I can provide one living example of someone who made it and who came from what we now call a disadvantaged background. Basically, I'm no different than many of them. As I think of black youth, I also want to say I believe that many of our pressing racial problems will be taken care of when we, who are among the minorities, will stand on our own feet and refuse to look to anybody else to save us from our situations. The culture in which we live stresses looking out for number one. Without adopting such a self-centered value system, we can demand the best of ourselves while we are extending our hands to help others. I see glimmers of hope. For example, I noticed that when the Vietnamese came to the United States, they often faced prejudice from everyone, white, black, and Hispanics. But they didn't beg for handouts and often took the lowest jobs offered. Even well-educated individuals didn't mind sweeping floors if it was a paying job. Today, many of these same Vietnamese are property owners and entrepreneurs. That's the message I try to get across to the young people. The same opportunities are there, but we can't start out as vice president of the company. Even if we landed such a position, it wouldn't do us any good anyway because we wouldn't know how to do our work. It's better to start where we can fit in and then work our way up. My story would be incomplete if I didn't add that during my year as an intern, when I was in general surgery, I had a conflict with one of the chief residents, a man from Georgia named Tommy. He couldn't seem to accept having a black intern at Johns Hopkins. He never said anything to that effect, but he continually threw caustic remarks my way, cutting me short ignoring me, sometimes being just plain rude. On one occasion, the underlying conflict came into the open when I asked, "Why do we have to draw blood from this patient? We still have because I said so," he thundered. I did what he told me. Several times that day, when I asked questions, especially if they began with "why," he snapped back the same reply. Late that afternoon, something happened that had nothing to do with me, but he was angry and, I knew from experience, would stay that way for a long time. He spun toward me, beginning, as he often did, with, "I'm a nice guy, but..." It hadn't taken me long to learn that those words contradicted his nice guy image. This time, he really laid into me. "You really do think you're something because you've had an early acceptance into the neurosurgery department, don't you? Everybody is always talking about how good you are, but I don't think you're worth salt on the earth. As a matter of fact, I think you're lousy. And I want you to know, Carson, that I could get you kicked out of neurosurgery just like that." He continued to rant for several minutes. I just looked at him and didn't say a word. When he finally paused, I asked in my calmest voice, "Are you finished?"
"Yeah."
"Fine," I answered calmly. That's all I said, all that was necessary. And he stopped ranting. He never did anything to me, and I wasn't concerned about his influence anyway. Although he was the chief resident, I knew that the chiefs of the departments were the ones who made the decisions. I was determined that I wasn't going to let him make me react, because then he would be able to get to me. Instead, I did my duties as I saw fit. Nobody else ever voiced any complaints about me, so I wasn't overly concerned about what he had to say. In the general surgery department, I encountered several men who acted like the pompous, stereotyped surgeons. It bothered me, and I wanted out of that whole thing. When I moved to neurosurgery, it wasn't like that. Dr. Donlin Long, who has chaired the neurosurgery department at Hopkins since 1973, is the nicest guy in the world. If anybody has earned the right to be pompous, it should be him because he knows everything and everybody, and technically, he is one of the best, if not the best, in the world. Yet he always has time for people and treats everyone nicely. Since the beginning, even when I was a lowly intern, I've always found him ready to answer my questions. He is about an inch under 6 feet and of average build. At the time I began my internship, he had salt and pepper hair, heavy on the pepper. Now his hair is mostly salt. He speaks with a deep voice, and people here at Hopkins are always imitating him. He knows they do it and laughs about it himself because he's got a great sense of humor. This is the man who became my mentor. I've admired him since the first time we met. For one thing, when I came to Hopkins in 1977, there were few blacks and none on the full-time faculty. One of the chief residents in cardiac surgery was black, Levi Watkins, and I was one of two black interns in general surgery, the other being Martin Goins, who also had gone to Yale. Many do their internship in general surgery, but fewer in neurosurgery. Some years, nobody from the Hopkins General Surgery Programs Division goes into neurosurgery. At the end of my intern year, 5 out of our group of 30 showed interest in going into neurosurgery. Of course, there were also the 125 people from other places around the country who wanted one of those slots. That year, Hopkins had only one open slot. After my year of internship, I faced 6 years of residency, one more year of general surgery, and 5 of neurosurgery. I was supposed to do 2 years of general surgery because I applied for neurosurgery, but I didn't want to do it. I didn't like general surgery, and I wanted to get out. I disliked general surgery so much, I was willing to sacrifice trying for a position in the neurosurgery department at Hopkins and go somewhere else if they would take me after only 1 year. I had gotten an extremely good recommendation through all my rotations as an intern. I was finishing my month rotation as an intern on the neurosurgery service and was reaching the point of writing to other schools. However, Dr. Long called me into his office. "Ben," he said, "you've done an extremely fine job as an intern."
"Thank you," I answered, pleased to hear those words.
"Well, Ben, we've noted that you've done extremely well in your rotation on the service. All of the attendings, that is, the surgeons, have been quite impressed with your work." Despite the fact that I wanted my features to remain passive, I know I must have been grinning widely. It's like this, he said, and leaned slightly forward. We'd be interested in having you join our neurosurgery program next year, rather than your doing an additional year's work in general surgery.
Thank you, I said, feeling my words were so inadequate. His offer was a definite answer to my prayers.
I was a resident at Johns Hopkins from 1978 through 1982. In 1981, I was a senior resident at Baltimore City Hospital, now Francis Scott Key Medical Center, owned by Johns Hopkins. In one memorable instance at Baltimore City, paramedics brought in a patient who had been severely beaten on the head with a baseball bat. This beating took place during the time of a meeting of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons in Boston. Most of the faculty was away at the meeting, including the faculty person who was covering at Baltimore City Hospital. The faculty member on duty at Johns Hopkins was supposed to be covering all the hospitals. The patient, already comatose, was deteriorating rapidly. Naturally, I was quite concerned, feeling we had to do something, but I was still relatively inexperienced. Despite making phone call after phone call, I couldn't locate the faculty member. With each call, my anxiety increased. Finally, I realized that the man would die if I didn't do something. And something meant a lobectomy, which I had never done before. Lobectomy means actually taking out the frontal lobe, while lobotomy means just cutting some fibers. What should I do? I started thinking of all kinds of roadblocks, such as the medical, legal ramifications of taking a patient to the OR without having an attending surgeon covering. It was illegal to perform such a surgery without an attending surgeon present. What happens if I get in there and run into bleeding I can't control? I thought. Or if I come up against another problem I don't know how to handle. If anything goes wrong, I'll have other people second-guessing my actions and asking, why did you do it? Then I thought, what is going to happen if I don't operate now? I knew the obvious answer. The man would die. The physician's assistant, Ed Rosenquist, who was on duty, knew what I was going through. He said just three words to me. Go for it. You're right, I answered. Once I made the decision to go ahead, a calmness came over me. I had to do the surgery, and I would do the best job I could. Hoping I sounded confident and competent, I said to the head nurse, "Take the patient to the operating room." Ed and I prepared for surgery. By the time the operation actually began, I was perfectly calm. I opened up the man's head and removed the frontal and temporal lobes from his right side because they were swelling so greatly. It was serious surgery, and one may wonder how the man could live without that portion of his brain. The fact is that these portions of the brain are most expendable. We had no problems during surgery. The man woke up a few hours later and subsequently was perfectly normal neurologically, with no ongoing problems. However, that episode evoked a great deal of anxiety in me. For a few days after I'd operated, I was haunted by the thought that there might be trouble. The patient could develop any number of complications, and I could be censured for performing the operation. As it turned out, no one had anything negative to say. Everyone knew the man would have died if I hadn't rushed him into surgery. A highlight for me during my residency was the research I did during my fifth year. For a long time, my interest had continued to grow in the areas of brain tumors and neuro-oncology. While I wanted to stay with doing this kind of research, we didn't have the right animals in which we could implant brain tumors. By working with small animals, researchers had long established that once they obtained consistent results, they could eventually transfer their findings toward finding cures, and then they could offer help to suffering human beings. This is one of the most fruitful forms of research to find cures for our diseases. Researchers had done a lot of work using mice, monkeys, and dogs, but they encountered problems. Dog models produced inconsistent results. Monkeys were prohibitively expensive. The murines, rats and mice, were cheap enough but so small that we couldn't operate on them. Neither did they image well with CT scans and MRI equipment. CTs are commonly called CAT scans for computerized tomography, a highly technical, sophisticated computer that allows the X-ray beams to focus at different levels. The magnetic resonance imaging doesn't use X-rays, but a magnet that excites the protons, microparticles, and the computer then gathers energy signals from these excited protons and transforms the protons into an image. MRI gives a clear-cut, definite picture of substances inside by reflecting the image based on the excitation of the protons. For instance, protons will be excited in a different degree in water than in bones or muscles or blood. All protons give off different signals, and the computer then translates them into an image. To accomplish the research I wanted, I faced a triple challenge. 1, to come up with a relatively inexpensive model. 2, to find one that was consistent. And 3, to find a model large enough to be imaged and operated on. My goal was to work with one type of animal and let that be the basis, or model, for our developmental research in brain tumors. A number of oncologists and researchers who had previously established working models counseled, "Ben, if you go ahead and begin to research brain tumors, you'd better expect to spend at least 2 years in the lab on the project." When I embarked on the project, I was willing to work that long or longer. But which animals should I use? While I initially started with rats, they were actually too small for our purpose. And personally, I hate rats. Maybe they triggered too many memories of my life in Boston's tenement district. I soon realized rats did not have the qualities necessary for good research, and I began to search for a different animal. During the next few weeks, I talked to a lot of people. One fabulous thing about Johns Hopkins is that they have experts who know practically everything about their own field. I started making the rounds among the researchers, asking, "What kind of animals do you use? Have you thought of any other kind?" After a lot of questions and many observations, I hit upon the idea of using New Zealand white rabbits. They perfectly fitted my threefold criteria. Someone at Hopkins pointed me to the research work of Dr. Jim Anderson, who was currently using New Zealand white rabbits. It was a thrill to walk into the lab there in the Blaylock building. Inside, I saw a large open area with an X-ray machine, a surgical table off to one side, a refrigerator, an incubator, and a deep sink. Another small section housed the anesthetics. I introduced myself to Dr. Anderson and said, "I understand that you've been working with rabbits." "Yes, I have," he answered, and told me the results he'd already obtained by working with what he called VX2 to cause tumors in the liver and kidneys. Over a period of time, his research showed consistent results. "Jim, I'm interested in developing a brain tumor model, and I wondered about using rabbits. Do you know any tumors that might grow in rabbits' brains?" "Well," he said, thinking aloud, "VX2 might grow in the brain." We talked a little more, and then I pushed him. "Do you really think VX2 will work?" "I don't see any reason why not. If it'll grow in other areas, there's a good chance it might grow in the brain." He paused and added, "If you want to, try it." "I'm game." Jim Anderson aided me immensely in my research. We first tried mechanical disassociation. That is, we used little screens to grate the tumors, much like someone would grate cheese. But they didn't grow. Second, we implanted chunks of tumors into the rabbits' brains. This time, they grew. To do what we call viability testing, I approached Dr. Michael Colvin, a biochemist in the oncology lab, and he sent me to another biochemist, Dr. John Hilton. Hilton suggested using enzymes to dissolve the connected tissue and leave the cancer cells intact. After weeks of trying different combinations of enzymes, Hilton came up with just the right combination for us. We soon had high viability. Almost 100% of the cells survived. From there, we concentrated the cells in the quantities we wanted. By refining the experiments, we also developed a way of using a needle to implant them into the brain. Soon, almost 100% of the tumors grew. The rabbits uniformly died with a brain tumor somewhere between the 12th and 14th day, almost like clockwork. When researchers have that kind of consistency, they can go on to learn how brain tumors grow. We were able to do CT scans and became excited when the tumors actually showed up. The magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, developed in West Germany, was a new technology just breaking on the scene at that time and wasn't available to us. Jim Anderson took several of the rabbits to Germany, imaged them on the MRI, and was able to see the tumor. I would have loved to go with him, and would have, except that I didn't have the money for the trip. Then we had the use of a PET scanner in 1982. PET, positron emission tomography, uses radioactive substances that can be metabolized by cells and gives off radioactive signals that can be picked up and translated. Just like the magnetic resonance imagery picks up electronic signals, this picks up radioactive signals and translates them into images. Hopkins was one of the first places in the country to get one. The first scans that we did on it were the rabbits with the brain tumors. Through the medical journals, we received wide publicity for our work. To this day, a lot of people at Johns Hopkins and other places are working with this brain tumor model. Ordinarily, this research would have taken years to accomplish, but I had so much collaborative effort with others at Hopkins, helping to iron out our problems, that the model was complete within 6 months. For this research work, I won the Resident of the Year award. This also meant that instead of staying in the lab for 2 years, I came out the next year and went on to do my chief residency. I began my year of chief residency with a quiet excitement. It had been a long, sometimes tough road. Long, long hours, time away from candy, study, patients, medical crises, more study, more patients. I was ready to get my hands on surgical instruments and to actually learn how to perform delicate procedures in a quick, efficient way. For example, I learned how to take out brain tumors and how to clip aneurysms. Different aneurysms require different sized clips, often put on at an odd angle. I practiced until the clipping procedure became second nature, until my eyes and instinct told me in a moment the type of clip to use. I learned to correct malformations of bone and tissue and to operate on the spine. I learned to hold an air-powered drill, weigh it in my hand, test it, then use it to cut through bone only millimeters away from nerves and brain tissue. I learned when to be aggressive and when to hold back. I learned to do the surgery that corrects seizures, learned how to work near the brainstem. During that intense year as chief resident, I learned the special skills that transformed the surgical instruments along with my hands, my eyes, and intuition into healing. Then I finished the residency. Another chapter of my life was ready to open, and, as often happens before life-changing events, I wasn't aware of it. The idea came across as impossible. At first. Chapter 13. A Special Year. I didn't explain the real reason to Bryant Stokes. I figured he knew it without my having to bring it out in the open. Instead, I answered, "Sounds like a nice place." Another time I said, "Who knows, maybe one day." "Be a grand place for you," he persisted. Each time he mentioned it, I gave Stokes another excuse, but I did think about what he said. One benefit especially appealed to me. You'd get as much experience in neurosurgery there in 1 year as you'd get in 5 years anywhere else. It seemed strange to me that Bryant Stokes persisted in the idea, but he did. A senior neurosurgeon in the United States from Perth, Western Australia, Bryant and I hit it off at once. Frequently, Bryant would say, "You should come to Australia and be a senior registrar at our teaching hospital." I tried various ways of getting him off the subject. "Thanks, but I don't think it's what I want to do." Or another time I said, "You've got to be kidding. Australia's on the other side of the world. You drill through from Baltimore and you come out in Australia." He laughed and said, "Or you could fly and be there in 20 hours. I tried evasive humor. "If you're there, who needs me or anyone else?" A matter of deep concern for me, which I naturally didn't mention, was that people had been telling me for years that Australia was worse with apartheid than South Africa. I couldn't go there because I'm black and they had a whites-only policy. Didn't he realize I was black? I dismissed the whole idea. Aside from the racial matter, from my perspective, I couldn't see that going to Australia for a year of residency would add anything in terms of my career, although it would certainly be interesting. If Brian hadn't been so persistent, I wouldn't have given the idea any more thought. Virtually every time we talked, he'd make a casual remark such as, "You know, you'd love Australia." I had other plans because Dr. Long, head of neurosurgery and my mentor, had already told me that I could stay on the faculty of Johns Hopkins after my residency. The fact that he added, "I'd be delighted to have you," made it all that more appealing. I couldn't think of anything more exciting than to remain at Hopkins, where so much research was going on. For me, Baltimore had become the center of the universe. Yet, strange as it seemed, although I dismissed Australia, the topic dogged me. It seemed that for a while, every time I went somewhere, I'd encounter someone with that particular accent saying, "G'day, mate. How you going?" Turning on the television, I hit commercials saying, "Travel to Australia and visit the land of the koala," and PBS advertised a special on the land down under. Finally, I asked Candy, "What in the world is going on? Is God trying to tell us something?" "I don't know," she answered, "but maybe we'd better talk a little about Australia." Immediately, I thought of a load of problems, the main one being the whites-only policy. I asked Candy to go to the library and check out books on Australia so we could find out about the country. The next day, Candy phoned me. "I found out something about Australia you ought to know." Her voice held an uncommon excitement, so I asked her to tell me right then. "That whites-only policy that's bothered you?" she said. "Australia used to have it. They abolished that law in 1968. I paused. What was happening here? "Maybe we ought to consider this invitation seriously," I told her. "Maybe we just ought to go to Australia." The more we read, the more Candy and I liked the idea. Before long, we were getting excited. Next, we discussed Australia with friends. With few exceptions, our well-intentioned friends discouraged us. One of them asked, "Why do you want to go to a place like that?" Another one said, "Don't you dare go to Australia. You'll be back in a week." "You wouldn't make Candy go through that, would you?" asked another. "Why, she's had such a bad time already. It'll be worse for her down there." I couldn't help smiling at this friend's words. His concern was our joy and niggling worry. Candy was pregnant, and it did seem foolish to fly to the other side of the world at this time. The problem was that in 1981, while I was chief resident, Candy became pregnant with twins. Unfortunately, she miscarried in her fifth month. Now, the following year, she was pregnant again. Because of the first experience, her doctor put her on bed rest after the fourth month. She quit her job and really looked after herself. When the question about her condition came up, Candy smiled each time but said firmly, "They do have qualified doctors in Australia, you know." Our friends didn't realize it, but we'd already decided to go, even though we didn't consciously know it ourselves. We had gone through the formal steps of making application to the Sir Charles Gardner Hospital of Queen Elizabeth II Medical Center, the major teaching center in Western Australia, and their only referral center for neurosurgery. I received a reply within 2 weeks. They had accepted me. "Guess that's our answer," I said to Candy. By then she was almost more excited about our going than I was. We would leave in June 1983 and were fully committed to the venture. We had to be fully committed because it took every dime we had to buy our tickets, one way. We wouldn't be able to come back even if we didn't like it. I would be doing 1 year as a senior registrar. The position of senior registrar doesn't exist in America, but lies somewhere between being a chief resident and a junior faculty member. The senior registrars run the service and work under the consultant. Following the British medical schools, Australia has what they call consultants, who are unquestionably the top men. Under this system, a doctor remains a senior registrar for many years. A doctor can become a consultant only when the incumbent dies. The government has a fixed number of such positions. Although they had only 4 consultants in Western Australia, these men were all extremely good, among the most talented surgeons I've ever seen. Each had his own area of expertise. I benefited from all their little tricks, and they aided me in developing my skills as a neurosurgeon. Several reasons made the venture attractive, one of which was the money. I would be getting a good salary in Australia, a lot more money than I'd ever made before, $65,000 for the year. And we badly needed the money. The salary was so attractive because I didn't have to pay exorbitant malpractice insurance. In Australia, it was only $200 a year. I know a number of prominent physicians who pay $100,000 to $200,000 a year in America. The difference lies in the fact that in Australia, relatively few malpractice cases arise. Australian law forbids lawyers to take malpractice cases on a contingency basis. People who want to sue have to take money from their own pockets. Consequently, the only people who sue are those upon whom doctors have made the most terrible mistakes. Although the racial issue was settled, Candy and I still flew to Perth with a great deal of trepidation. We didn't know what kind of reception we'd receive. We had legitimate concerns because I'd be an unknown surgeon entering a new hospital. Despite her brave talk, Candy was pregnant, and the possibility of problems stayed in our minds. But the Australians received us warmly. Our being affiliated with the Seventh-day Adventist Church opened many doors. On our first Saturday in Australia, we went to church and met the pastor and several members before worship began. During the service, the pastor announced, "We have a family from the United States with us today. They're going to be here for a year." He then introduced Candy and me and encouraged the members to greet us. And they did. When the service concluded, everybody crowded around us. Seeing that my wife was pregnant, many women asked, "What do you need?" We had brought nothing in preparation for the baby, since we were limited in the amount of luggage we could carry from the United States, and those wonderful people started bringing in bassinets, blankets, baby strollers, and diapers, which they called nappies. We were constantly receiving invitations to dinner. People at the hospital couldn't figure out how, within 2 weeks of our arrival, we had met a lot of people and were receiving a constant stream of invitations. One of my fellow residents, who had been there 5 months, asked, "What are you doing tonight?" I mentioned that we were having dinner with a certain family. The resident knew that only a few days earlier, a different family had taken us on a scenic trip outside Perth. "How in the world do you know so many people?" he asked. "You've only been over here a fortnight. It took me months to meet this many people." "We come from a large family," I said. "You mean you have relatives here in Australia?" "Sort of," I chuckled and then explained. "In the church, we think of ourselves as all part of God's family. That means that we think of the people where we worship as brothers and sisters, part of our family. The church people have been treating us like the family members we are." He'd never heard such a concept before. From the day we arrived, I liked Australia. Not just the people, but the land and the atmosphere. Being hired as a senior registrar also meant that I got to do most of the cases. That responsibility boosted my appreciation for being in the land down under. Even Candy became really involved, as a first violinist in the Netherlands Symphony, and a vocalist in a professional group. A full month hadn't passed when an extremely difficult case came to our attention and changed the direction of my work in Perth. The senior consultant had diagnosed a young woman as having an acoustic neuroma, a tumor that grows at the base of the skull. It causes deafness and weakness of the facial muscles, eventually resulting in paralysis. This patient also suffered from frequent and extreme headaches. The tumor was so large that, with the consultant's decision to take it out, he told the patient that he wouldn't be able to save any of her cranial nerves. After hearing the prognosis, I asked the senior consultant, "Do you mind if I try to do this using a microscopic technique? If it works, I can possibly save the nerves." "It is worth trying, I'm sure." While the words were polite enough, the real flavor of his feeling came through. I knew he was saying, "You young whippersnapper, just try and then see yourself fail." And I couldn't blame him. The surgery took 10 straight hours without rest. Naturally, when I finished, I was exhausted, but also elated. I had completely removed the tumor and saved her cranial nerves. The senior consultant could tell her she would likely enjoy a complete recovery. Within a short time after her recovery, the woman became pregnant. When the baby was born, in gratitude, she named the child after her consultant because she thought he had taken out her tumor and saved her cranial nerves. She didn't know that I had done the delicate work. Actually, things are done that way. In Australia, the senior registrar works under the auspices of the consultant, and he, as the top man, gets the credit for successful surgery, no matter who actually performs it. The others on the staff, of course, knew. After that surgery, the other senior consultants suddenly showed me enormous respect. From time to time, one of them would come up to me and ask, "Say, Carson, can you cover a surgery for me?" Eager to learn and anxious for more experience, I don't recall turning down a case, which gave me a tremendous load.